Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is free and available now for iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices.
3-10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Weekend Confirmed.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
Hey everybody, welcome to a awesome-tacular, spectacular, fantastic, amazing, wonderful, stupendous...
Fantasgrate?
Fantasgrate. Brutality. Brutalicious. Weekend Confirmed. That rattle, by the way, was Andrea. She has rattly jewelry.
I'll take it off right now, actually.
Hold on. I just wanted to make it rattle some more.
Losing the bling.
Yeah, she's losing the bling. You lost the bling.
The bling is off. I was going to take it off earlier and I forgot. Whoops. Sorry.
From machinima.com, that would be the lovely Andrea Renee.
Hi, everybody.
And we brought the Jeffs back.
Yeah,
Double Jeff tag. That's right.
Double Jeff style.
Because one Jeff would not be enough, and three Jeffs is just too many.
Yeah, way too many.
You know, I wish I had been at South by Southwest because Jazzy Jeff did a set. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that happened.
I bet he looks at the Fresh Prince and is all like, have a good career, bro.
Or he's like, dude, I stayed legit. I stayed true.
Yeah.
I stayed true.
Keeping it real.
Stayed jazzy.
I kept to the jazzy.
How long do you think it took him to think of that name? Like, and how long did it, Jeff?
How long did it take before you regretted it?
Or how sad was he?
What other J things are there that could do?
Juicy?
No, not juicy. Justice? No, I kind of do music. There's something musical.
Yeah.
Jubilation?
Jubilation.
And how big did he cringe when people started getting vajazzled?
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. Poor guy. Anyway, so we have a lot to talk about on this show. We are going to come back to Mass Effect 3. I think we have really no choice. I know a lot of you were excited by us talking about Mass Effect 3 last week. Some of you wanted us to do spoiler cast, and then others of you thought we spent too much time on Mass Effect 3. So this week, some of you will be excited, others of you will be pissed, and all of you will be posting in the threads comments and telling us all about it, I'm sure.
Indeed.
But we won't be just doing Mass Effect, but I think the reason we have to come back to Mass Effect is to discuss some of BioWare's responses, which are pretty radical in the gaming world. Obviously,
I would say in the media world at large.
Unprecedented, one might say.
Well, I don't know if they're unprecedented.
Really?
Well, I mean, there's been other amendments to media, to pop culture. George Lucas says hi.
Fan-driven, though. Those weren't fan-driven.
Right. Okay. So obviously the fan element has a big part to do with this. Anyway, we'll talk about that. We also are going to talk about Journey, of course. We're going to start off talking about Journey, so you don't have to wait for that part. We played some other games. I'm having a bit of a Mass Effect 3 hangover, too. We were talking about this in the pre-show video. I played a bunch of iPad games this week.
Just as a sort of, let's take a break from the big, sprawling, epic AAA title and get to something a little simpler?
It wasn't as mentally thought out as that. Mm-hmm. It was just a thing.
Pure reaction.
Actually, we could just talk about that. Like, do you guys ever have that when you finish a big game and then have some sort of natural letdown after it?
Postpartum depression.
Yes, postpartum depression.
You gave birth to that experience.
And admittedly, I think that a lot of people would say, "Oh, well, that was because of the caliber of the ending." But I think it's happened to me in other games. You know, I finished Red Dead, and then it's just like you just sort of get to the end, and you're like, "Wow, that was awesome!" And you know, you're maybe a little. I don't know.
I do that with a lot of things, though, too, with reading a book. When I finish reading a book, I will oftentimes not launch into another big sprawling book, but I will read something a little lighter first. So I think that's natural, yeah.
So I also played Journey and played Cinemora some, so we got some of that stuff to talk about. The two Jeffs went down and saw the now coming into beta Mists of Pandaria.
Yes, we did. Lots of pandas.
Yeah,
we'll
talk about our Pandaria.
They're so cute, pandas. That's all I have to say about that.
Exactly. And her reaction is exactly one of the pieces I want to talk about, which is how weird the messaging is on this expansion pack because it's got something for everybody.
They are very conscious of that, though. That's one thing that I came away from that going. They know exactly. We can talk about it when we talk about it. But yeah, they address that head on at the presentation.
All right. And Andrea's been playing a crap ton of Mass Effect. Apparently that's
as
it.
Usual.
So. Well, you know, me, Mass Effect, we go way back.
She's been getting busy with her Shepard.
No, I've been getting busy with my blue girlfriend. Wow.
Oh. We talked about the romance things last week and won't go into that. Anyway, so let's talk about some Journey. M.H. Silver will kick us off, who posted this comment last week and then repeated it. And I think it does bear repeating because it's a very good analogy to lay it out. He says, the best analogy I can make for a Journey comes from personal experience, jamming with friends. I play the guitar. Some of my friends do as well. And two others play bass and drums. When we sit and chill and just start playing, there's very little actual chatting. We don't say, I'm going to go play in this time, or I'm going to switch it up. We just go, we do our thing, and then everybody follows suit. We riff on each other. We hear what the other person is doing and decide how to react and compliment them. And this feels remarkably similar in Journey. If I see another player walking in a certain direction or trying to jump to a specific part of the environment or whatever, then I try to follow suit or help or get their attention and pull them in the direction I want to go. Have you had that same experience? Because that was sort of the light bulb moment of Journey.
Yes and no. I expected there to be more of that than what I've only played through the game once, and I'm hoping to play through it again. So I only had one experience. One of the most disappointing things for me, though, was at the end realizing that I played with like six different people.
Yeah.
Because I played it in one sitting, as I recommend everyone do.
And you didn't get the trophy for playing with one person.
Well, but
yeah, I mean,
I have no control over that.
I know.
But I thought I was playing with one person. I thought, oh, I'm yep. making this connection with this other human. And I get to the end, I'm like, oh no, that was six dudes. I'm kind of bummed because I thought I thought we had something. I thought we had something special.
So to get that achievement, do you have to go through the whole thing with one single person to get like every level, or
I scanned through the trophies, and there's a trophy for completing it with one, or completing a majority of them.
But you have no control. That just happens.
So in other words, Journey is like your glory hole.
Oh, Garnet Lee, with your mouth, just filthy mouth.
What? I'm just saying. That's kind of the way you described it. You're saying I was getting busy with six people.
Well,
didn't even know it, but it was amazing.
Well,
that's true.
The experience of playing
it's
Journey,
like a roadside stop in Tennessee.
Okay. Oh Lord,
here we go. He's still talking about this. So yeah. That. Yep.
Did you pass any notes underneath the stall?
Series of foot positions convey everything. Garnet, you
I wouldn't know, but evidently that's
that.
You're familiar.
The experience of playing the game was very profound for me. I will say, terrible segue from what you were talking about, but I am a little embarrassed to say I actually welled up with tears while playing Journey.
Why would you be embarrassed?
Yeah, don't be embarrassed. Well, I think it's
a cheesy thing to admit, and I think
not at all.
It sounds I think it can come off a little like, I don't know.
Like you're a softy.
I am a softy. I'm an admitted softy. But
they were manly tears.
I didn't cry at the end.
Right.
I cried on the mountain.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
No, I will admit too. I didn't actually. I got choked up. I didn't actually fully, cry. But,
yeah.
Which I've done before at games.
It's a profound experience, and it's one I think everybody should experience. But And we won't be spoilers, so don't get scared.
Well, I think it would be a very hard game to spoil in a traditional sense anyway.
Well,
because
I had no idea some of the things were going to happen that happened.
Sure.
Or whatever.
And while those could be spoiled, I think that in a traditional sense of the laying out structural elements would still not spoil the game in as much as so much of it is the act of playing it, exploring it, and discovering it.
Well, the reason I bring this up and the reason I came at it this direction from what you said specifically, the question you framed, is that...
What was the question I framed?
Which is talking about playing with someone else.
Oh, right. Okay.
And is that part of the thing that got me emotionally mm-hmm. was that the game really works as a beautiful metaphor for life. Mm-hmm. And there's not very many games that do.
Right.
So, there's plenty that do, but there's, it's all too rare, unfortunately. The idea, especially in the latter third of the game, the idea that I've been with this other person, which I assumed was the same other person the whole time.
I assumed the same thing, and I'm apparently wrong about
right,
that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's definitely a metaphor for that thing in life where you sort of, you know, you find your mate and you go on this journey and things are difficult and hard and trying, and you help each other in ways that are oftentimes nonverbal and oftentimes very subtle. And I found that to be such a beautiful expression of that, that I think being with another person that I knew to be a human being completely added to that feeling and brought home that concept, that metaphor of the journey of life, which, well, I think they're very conscious of doing.
And something else that I noticed is that the cooperative nature of the behavior of the other player and I was completely – there was no antagonism there, even from the get-go. There was never any –
Genova would be very happy to hear you say that, because they worked very hard on getting that right.
Oh, yeah. And it works. I mean, we just – one of us would see the other one off in the distance and – one would join up with the other, and if somebody got a little bit ahead, they'd wait yeah. for the other person to catch up. And
yeah, that's the thing that really surprised me too, because there's a point at which I was going up something and I fell off, and the other person didn't.
Right.
And I had to go up a different way to catch back up with them. And I assumed that when I got back up, he would be gone.
Yeah, they'd be like, forget it.
I'm saying he, but who knows? It could have been a she, I suppose. But that person stayed and waited for me to get back to that point. And it was such a small thing, but yeah. it meant a lot. You know?
And the game encourages that somehow. Yeah. And it's really hard to articulate why, but it makes you want to be cooperative.
It's funny that you said in the distance, because one of the things that I've enjoyed is that, I'm sure that there's some planning that goes into this, is that I found that many times when someone comes into the game or I realize someone is in the game, it's by virtue of seeing them not up close to me. It's not like I have this immediacy of slamming into a person, mm-hmm. but I see them over on the other side of a large expanse. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, there's somebody else doing something in this world with me.
Are there people in your game from the start? Because I never saw anybody until I was about halfway through. And I thought that was really profound, like life in a lot of ways.
I don't know exactly where the entry point is, and I don't know exactly how they're doing it. But as you said, you had six people that you played with interactively, you know, mm-hmm. over the course of your journey. And it is very much a slipstream sort of thing of like people hop in and they drop out. And there are those transitions between chapters during which things could change.
Right.
And then sometimes those can be a little disorienting. So you may not exactly have a quick grasp of where you are and when someone is joining in and out. And mm-hmm. so I don't know exactly when someone can join you, but I do think that...
Because I knew a lot about the fact that would happen, and so I was looking for it early, and I liked the fact that it didn't happen right away for me.
Well, I don't think it's until, like, the earliest I've ever seen someone is in, like, that third big space.
Mm-hmm. I actually saw someone right after the title comes up.
Really?
Yeah, I was in the area that follows that. And they were with me through the whole game up until the very end.
Oh,
and,
cool.
And not the, like, the very last bit that you play, that person wasn't with me. And I'm not sure if they could be with you or not based on how things unfold.
there was a person with me for that.
Oh, there was.
Yeah.
See,
it was
because
magical.
That is part of the reason that I got choked up is because I went through this whole experience with this other or six other people or whatever. But when I got to the end, I was like, oh, my God, where's... And I waited and I waited and...
No, for me, it was the two of us.
And then you realized I don't even know their name.
Yeah, and I don't even know their name. I don't know... They're not coming back, and I guess I better just go. And then I was like, whoa. You know, it was really cool.
Yeah. It's a... $15, a little over an hour. You at first think, well, I don't know about this. But I can't imagine a more moving...
Will you play it again?
I would like to. I want my girlfriend to play it by herself. I want her to play it. I think it's
Amy.
The kind
you
of
need
thing...
to play it. You hear that? She's gonna play. She's gonna. She's nodding. She's gonna play Journey. We have her on the hook.
Yeah,
she is hooked.
It's the kind of thing. I love the fact that it's short enough that you can sit someone down and say, "You have to play through this from start to finish right now." It's like watching a movie, basically.
Right.
And someone who doesn't play video games can absolutely grasp it.
And by the way, it's a great argument for the controller. And the Wii thing not being the only way to make games accessible, because I feel pretty strongly that you could hand a controller to someone and, I mean, the game's pretty pick up and playable.
Yeah.
Or, and by that, I don't even mean just pick up and playable for a gamer, but pick up and like, oh, I get it. Okay. So I'm, you know, I'm moving around.
I'm walking.
And yeah. I can even, and you know, I can use the sticks for a camera if I want to, but I can fly the camera around with a controller. It's like, it's just.
Well, and it's, again, it goes back to the elegance of design because there, other than the title screen, there's no text, no nothing. It's just straight up, you know, your visual.
So let me ask you about the emotional response piece, because clearly, as a nearly united front, everyone who considers themselves core gamers are rallying around this game. Another one of those that game company games where we're all rallying around them and saying, this is an emotional, you know, an emotional ride. It really pulls out those elements.
It's a fuck you Ebert game.
And
yeah, good. And well put.
So I get accused a lot of playing devil's advocate. So I'll just be transparent about this. I agree with that. However, I have to call into question sometimes, like, are we fooling ourselves into that? How much of that is because we want it to be emotional? How much of that is because we want to look at it and say, oh, let's be artistic and read something into this?
Well, I can tell you my experience was you go through it and it's beautiful and you pick up all the obvious aesthetic things right away. Mm-hmm. But that moment that I that moment that I told you about where the other person disappeared and I had that sort of like realized they disappeared at the time that the story was sort of coming full circle. And the combination of those two things just – it triggered a very human response in me, and it really didn't have much to do with what I was looking at on screen. It was had to do with what I had just experienced in the past 45 minutes. So, I mean, that's –
And for me, what happened was a thing that happens with all good art, and that is – I'm using the A word, but so be it. That is I was doing something – that made me think of things in my own life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was looking, you know, you can look at a painting or you can read a book or you can watch a film or whatever. And those things that resonate and feel like truth in your own life will get you. And or at least they do for me. And there was a moment where I went, oh, my God, this is a metaphor for the struggles of life. And I started thinking about myself and, you know, whatever. And that's a beautiful thing that wasn't forced and wasn't me looking for it to happen. It just sort of naturally happened. And that's what great art does.
I'll agree. And I'll cop to not only – I mean, one of the reasons I said that about, you know, asking for contrary opinions is I think that there's a large part of me that wants to be validated in my emotional response to the game and feel like that's really genuine because it's freaky. I mean, it's really almost freaky how – you're playing the game, and for me, it transcended holding a game controller and playing a game. So for me, I love role-playing games, and I really get into my role-playing games. Like, I really, especially Mass Effect, you know, as a great example, is I was projecting into that character a whole fiction that I was composing in my mind and thinking about, you know, where I wanted the character to go and all those sorts of things. But the response that Journey created is on a whole other wavelength. On a whole other wavelength of it's almost like being some sort of psychological test subject or something, because you're no longer just you're not playing a game to be playing a game. You're just doing this thing with these other people and experiencing a framework. And there's some sensory stuff and there's some interpersonal relationship stuff. And there's also some solo discovery stuff. And yeah, it totally got to me, obviously.
You know, and we're in an industry here. We're talking about an industry that's, what, 30 years old?
Yeah.
And we're just at the beginning of this. We're just at the beginning. Yeah. And I have nothing against the escapist, shoot 'em up. I love all those games, obviously.
Yeah.
But we're just starting to see what interactive entertainment can really bring to the table as far as an artistic expression, having something to say about life. And I think it's very exciting for me because as much as I love all that other stuff, and I truly do, I love shooting stuff and I love having a great time. And I love spectacle. But the other side is nourishing in a completely different way. And it's exciting. I'm glad that there's people shooting for that kind of, you know.
Me too. For everyone at that game company, thank you so much
for
putting it into that and getting that right, because it's really amazing. It is really amazing. Oh, and I know another thing. How's your response to this? Because I saw some people tweeting about this as I was talking about Journey, that they stuck to their guns, and though you have had those shared experiences and built those personal bonds, they don't let you ever connect with that person in a real way. You never know their name.
Well, no, you do. You know their name at the end, right?
Well, but through the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's, I think that's important in a weird way. You know, it's important that you can't.
And you can't go play that game. You can't go
say, hey, I want to play with you, Garnet. Yes. Let's go do it. Yeah. I think that's important. I think it wouldn't be the same experience if I knew it was Garnet Lee on the other end.
Yeah, because you'd bring a set of personal relationship baggage to it, whatever it might be, good, bad, and different.
Right.
Well, and you wouldn't be as sort of accommodating and polite with the other player because you'd be like, all right, I know this is so and so. I'm gonna yeah, exactly.
Just that sound that it makes is so.
I have another question.
It's
for you guys.
It resonates with me so much. Just that.
Yeah. This is maybe a weird question, but it occurred to me that. What is your point of view on the pieces of fabric themselves? Because
meaning in their game or
in the game, I found myself not wanting to pass up any of the pieces of fabric because, and this sounds, I acknowledge that this sounds strange, but I found myself feeling like I was saving them, like I anthropomorphized them a little bit, and I was saving, like I was.
Oh, interesting.
Did you, because I feel like one could either look at them as sort of little beings that you're rescuing from their state of decay, or, which is kind of what I did, or just tools to get you from one place to another. Did you think of it as, oh, I can use that as a means of transportation? Or even just a little piece of fabric sticking out of the sand, I was like, I'm not passing that up because I need to save it. I need to like rescue it.
Oh, no. The gamer in me was very much like, okay, I'm going to go activate all these. You know, or reactivate all these threads and ribbons and stuff. But I didn't really anthropomorphize them as much. It did sort of make me wonder about what their origin was and what their purpose in the world was in the fiction of the story. But that was sort of the extent.
You're going to think I'm such a goofball nerd.
What?
Because I was...
what I said wasn't goofball and nerdy? I was sappy and ridiculous.
I sort of... very quickly fell into the whole journey as a metaphor for your evolution through, you know, your life experiences. And so for me, I quickly started to latch on to this idea that the scarf was building all of these assemblages of your, were representative of all the experiences that you gained through. Yeah, the tapestry, exactly, a tapestry of your life. And as you build the tapestry of life, it enables you to be freer from the ground and fly to higher, to achieve higher heights.
That makes a lot more sense to me, actually.
It's the kind of discussion that this game engenders that it sounds so pretentious.
I don't want to sound like that. I was really into that. And so I was always on this like,
you sort of have to indulge yourself.
I want to go explore and I want to go find those things because the more I experience in this world, the richer my journey is going to be. And the richer my journey is going to be, the higher I'm going to be able to soar. And Yeah.
Buy the game. Experience it. Mm-hmm. I think it's worthwhile for everybody.
Absolutely.
One of the best things I've played.
Andrea Renee, play this game.
I will play it tonight. It's already downloaded on my
Just carve out an hour and a half, and do it all in one sitting. That's the way it's meant to be. I think Flower was like that, too. Like, best played all in one sitting.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's also cumulative. It builds on each emotion, and you get those moments of impact, and they build on one another, and they feel really good.
Yeah.
They feel really good. Playing together always makes a game more fun, right?
Yeah.
So you excited about Epic Mickey 2? The Power of Two.
Wow, it's hard for me to think of a game that was more disappointing to me than the first Epic Mickey. I was so excited when it was announced.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you talk about a property, or a world like Disney has, and they were talking about Epic Mickey, and I was like, how exciting to have like all of these, you know, potential Disney characters all in one game together. And then it comes out and you're like, wait a minute, where are all the characters? It's really like almost like a solo journey with Mickey, and then you can run into the same people over and over again. But I'm really like, I'm holding out hope that they'll get it right this time.
Just pure mechanics is what was the problem for me in that game. Like
the camera angles were horrible.
Camera and jumping was
dark.
Crap. And
yeah,
it just,
the platforming mechanics were bad. Yeah.
Apparently, the camera's getting a lot of work.
Needs it. Yeah.
Fully voiced characters now.
Yes. So
gosh.
That was actually one of the things that Warren was skeptical of originally on the first game was doing voices at all. So now that you know they decide they went that direction, they're going to be okay. We're going to do them all.
Well, everything. I just would like to point out there if anybody. Out there needs a Donald Duck. I can step up to the plate and do Donald Duck.
Really?
Give it to us.
That's That's amazing. That's I'm very impressed great. Right now.
Yeah, right. Wow. I'm glad you didn't talk about Journey like that. And then that would have been embarrassing.
When Donald gets pissed off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. It's fun times. Good times.
That's awesome. So yeah, Epic Mickey sequel is The Power of Two. It's going to be a cooperative experience. It's drop-in and drop-out co-op. There'll be a AI, of course, playing your partner as long as you're not connected. And then when someone wants to, they can come in, take charge of the AI right away. And if they drop out, your game won't end. Of course, the AI will pick right up. You'll be still be playing Mickey as the main role. The AI will be Oswald. So evidently Warren has like this big thing about Oswald, who's the character that Disney...
The first Walt created character.
Right, which they lost the rights to in the 20s and just gained them back in the late 2000s, I think 2006, if I remember the story correctly. And so let me see how this can work. The abilities, Mickey has a paintbrush still. Oswald has his remote control. They'll be complimentary to go back and forth.
Now, oh, here's that Adam Sandler movie.
Here's the kicker. That, you know, Warren was very true to this whole Disney cartoon experience thing, right? So he wants to bring in another element to really sort of grasp that, really reflecting the Disney cartoon thing. Here's a quote from him. This will be the first musical comedy game.
What?
The musical numbers will not be interactive, but part of the cinematics. There will be several songs in the game, and that Jim Dooley of Pushing Daisies wrote a dynamic score for all the songs. So... if you think about it, I mean, it does make sense. Think about all the classic Disney films.
Yeah.
Musical is a huge part of it.
Certainly.
And it's certainly an element that if they were getting close enough that you were starting to make that association with Epic Mickey, it would definitely be piece that would stand out to you. Oh, where's the, you know, where's the Under the Sea?
Well, here's my worry. I just hope, based on what I know of the first game, that it isn't going to be like all this awesome stuff that are cutscenes between really boring, crappy things that I actually do. I want the things that I do to be as fun as the promise of the world, and the musical numbers are awesome. That's great, but I don't want to have to just play a really.
Oh, I'm sure they'll attach them to a QTE or something.
Well, aww. I mean, I think some of the most fun parts of the original Epic Mickey was the 2D kind of connector scene.
Yeah, give me that
scenes,
game.
Know?
Give me that game.
Yeah, that
for
was
sure.
Cool.
That was awesome.
So hopefully there's more of that and less fetch quests for random crap.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there's still more of this show coming up. We're going to come right back. When we do, we will hop into the Mass Effect follow up on Dr. Ray's comments. Let Andrea talk a little bit about her N7 weekend. And there's still more to come, so stick around. Weekend Confirmed. We'll be right back. Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is filled with game information, the latest gaming news from shacknews.com, and videos and screenshots for over 8,000 games. New version 2.0 for the iPhone and iPod Touch includes cool new features like social interaction. Now you can follow and interact with the crew from Weekend Confirmed in the Gamefly app. Check out what Jeff Cannata, Del Rio, and I are playing and saying about the latest games. And as always, the app is free and available now for the iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices. All right, folks, still coming up. Hey, Kepler, which is the next big NVIDIA chipset. We've been knowing about it for a little while, but GTX 680 is finally ready to hit the shelves. $500. We're going to talk about those a little bit and what they mean for where PC gaming could go.
I want that. Give one to me.
Why don't you just go buy one? But for many BioWare fans who started off as PC fans, they'll know the two doctors who are the figureheads and, you know, the primary creative motivating force for a long time for BioWare. Of course, they've gotten very broad now. And Dr. Ray gave a very thorough statement to fans on social.bioware.com, which is their web forums, about the response over the endings to Mass Effect 3. And I've condensed it some here to some high points, so I'll just kind of give you like this quick read-through. Do note that I am skipping in a couple spots. If you want to read the whole thing, it's over on social.bioware.com. So here's the excerpts from his statement. It's incredibly painful to receive feedback from our core fans that the game's endings were not up to their expectations. Our first instinct is to defend our work and point to the high ratings offered by critics, but out of respect to our fans, we need to accept the criticism and feedback with humility. To that end, since the game launched, the team has been poring over everything they can find about reactions to the game. Industry press, forums, Facebook and Twitter, just to name a few. Building on their research, Executive producer Casey Hudson and the team are hard at work on a number of game content initiatives that will help answer the questions, providing more clarity for those seeking further closure to their journey. You'll hear more on this in April. We're working hard to maintain the right balance between the artistic integrity of the original story while addressing the fan feedback we've received. This is in addition to our existing plan to continue providing new Mass Effect content and new full games. So rest assured that your journey in the Mass Effect universe can and will continue.
For just an extra $10.
Okay. You know what? It's funny you said that, because one of the very first points exactly. that came up under this on the Shack right. was a bunch of people who are like, well, they can't. Or can they charge for this clarity and closure DLC? Well,
they better not.
They better not. But I don't think they will. But they could.
What makes you say that you think they won't? Well, they're putting a lot of work into it.
I'm sure there is a war going on right now inside BioWare between creative and marketing about.
How about just in general work bandwidth? I mean, here you've got a game where you already had DLC plans and next game plans. So those are all product mark planned out. Like, they've figured out timelines, how they're going to pay for themselves and everything else. Now we're going to suddenly do all this other stuff, and it's taking research time, plus someone's got to figure out what it's going to be and how it's going to work and not screw things up. This is
pretty crazy.
They're
obviously pushing some of that other scheduled DLC to accommodate this. I mean, you would think, right?
I think they're probably just going to add like a text scroll at the end.
A winner is you.
Yeah. P.S.
It's interesting. Yeah.
Some other stuff happened. Yeah.
We were talking about in the break of how this is almost unprecedented that we've seen such a fan outcry and then the creators coming and saying, all right, we hear you. We'll do something about it. And I for one, am really disappointed that BioWare is caving to the squeaky wheels out there, because I honestly don't think that represents the majority of Mass Effect fans. At least the people that I know and that I've talked to about the game all have, you know, their opinions about the way that that the ending is, but none of them have said BioWare screwed it up, I want them to change it, they need to give me the ending that I want. None of them have said that. And I think it's kind of tragic that the community is seen like as an opportunity for them to demand, you know, some kind of creative end. Like, I mean, Jeff, you were saying, like, where do people get off trying to say, tell an artist that they need to change their art?
Yeah, so, I think Stephen King wrote a book called Misery that's pretty much about this exact thing.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
To be fair, this statement makes it pretty clear that they are not going to change the artistic integrity of the ending.
So no Shepard.
What is that?
What is
that
means that the weirdness of the ending is not going to change. Now, they may give you more clarity. Remember last week we were talking about, and this came up on the comments in the show thread, you know, someone made a comment about how much stuff there was after the resolution of Lord of the Rings, where you're like going here and then going here and going here, and finally you're back in the Shire. They said, fuck it, I don't even care about these hobbits anymore. Just end the damn movie. And I think that's part of it. Is that in this case, you had so many characters with which you had relationships that when you got to the end, you wanted to know more about those things. Now, that having been said, I thought that in the... I want to be careful because we don't want to spoil our stuff. I thought that even in the run to the conclusion, that it was evident that they were having trouble dealing with those relationships in the ham-handed way in which they handled those critical moments with your friends at the end of the game.
Right.
Here's the thing.
Is that fair way to say that without being a spoiler?
That's definitely a fair. I feel
it was very mechanical.
I feel like you spent three games building up these relationships, and it came down to like this almost like a 15 minute wrap up right before that leads to the final mission, where you're like,
well, Jeff, it's like the computer in One, which you hated.
Which I hated. Yeah.
So but
that's where I really want to be clear, because I got a lot of feedback last week, and it's, I think it's easy to conflate two different issues when talking about this. And for me, they're very distinct. And one of them is legitimate criticism of the way the ending plays out or not, like saying, boy, I didn't like that, or I did like that, or I feel somewhere in between. Right. Which is completely fair game, and people can have whatever discussion about that they want to have. I'm all for it. The second thing is this going into a space of I am owed something, or I demand a change, or you have to do more to appease me because I purchased this game, or I spent three full games of time with these people. I find that the latter of those two things to be so wildly out of proportion with what people should expect. And I think it's an example of the inmates running the asylum to have the head of BioWare. Like, listen, they certainly want to cultivate fans, and they want to appease those fans. They want people to keep coming back and buying their product, and that's great. But to have people, you know, have a petition or demand a change, and then to have them capitulate to that,
never make everyone happy.
You can never follow the vicissitudes of your audience.
Actually, that's a really good point. You can never make anyone happy. Yeah. Go ahead. Help me on vocabulary there. The
wild fluctuations of opinion, right? Because what someone thinks one time, what you think in the heat of the moment oftentimes isn't what you feel years
down
the line.
Dude, Lord knows that I am, as a romantic guy, I am so freaking guilty of that. As anyone who's listened to the shows I've done over the last 7 years knows, I could come in here and flip a lid 1 week and then next week be like, okay, I'm kind of okay now.
And I guarantee you the people who created these things have put far more thought into what the characters and all that than you did. And it's okay not to like it. I'm not criticizing anyone for not liking it. I'm saying that, you know, Sessler and I were having this conversation the other day. I was up in San Francisco, and we just were talking about it. And he's a much smarter guy than I am, and he was saying numerous examples through history of, from example of why I'm not smart. Christmas Carol writer, the guy who wrote A Christmas Carol.
Oh my God.
Come on.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I'm blanking out too.
Anybody?
Okay. We all feel
Dickens?
Like a bunch of
yeah,
idiots.
Dickens. Yes, thank you. Charles Dickens. You know, he wrote most of his stuff.
Wow.
I was just kind of watching you guys. It was like a deer in headlights. It was amazing.
It's like my brain fell out.
I immediately went to my iPad. I was like, I will Google this.
Don't do good on game shows.
My brain was faster than your Google.
Anyway, Charles Dickens wrote a lot of his stuff. We would put out a chapter at a time, right? Serialized,
yep.
And, you know, there was an outcry when he killed his character Nell, I believe, from, I don't know. See, I'm not
she,
very
she
smart.
Was Tae and then the Wind, or, oh, no, that's a different Nell.
Anyway, like I said, he brought it up, and he had numerous examples of that with things that are now considered great art. And I'm not saying the Mass Effect should be considered great art, but the point is that you don't get to decide. You don't get to decide.
Exactly.
Right? You can be mad. Listen, I hate Episode One, Star Wars Episode One. I think George Lucas, unfortunately, I was so wrongheaded in so many decisions that made on that movie. But I would never deign to say that he doesn't get to make the movie he wants to make. Like, I think it was a wrong choice, and there may be a discussion to have about whether this was the right choice. And I think you guys were kind of having that discussion just now.
Mm-hmm.
But where people start going over the line for me, and what I wanted to mock last week, and a lot of people got pissed off, like, oh, you hate your audience, whatever, blah, blah, blah. What I was mocking is the decision to go, not only do I hate the ending, but I think I am owed a change to the ending.
Right.
And I think that's a weird place for our culture to be at.
I tweeted, you're an ass clown. For reals. Like, I mean, the guy that filed a complaint with the FTC against...
That one is,
you know,
probably
I mean?
The biggest crazy extension of the whole thing.
What world do we live in?
To think that... And people... And
you know
what I tweeted, if you guys follow me on Twitter, I tweeted this morning that if you are one of the people that went through the whole game, the 30 hours of gameplay or whatever, however long it took you, and you finished it and you got to
the
end...
That's pretty fast. I think I was like 40.
I mean, that's like if you're not doing all like the little side stuff, right?
Okay.
So you get to the end, and you afterwards you're not satisfied in some way, and then thinking that you should be able to demand to get your money back for that creative experience. That's just asinine to me, because there's so many amazing things that happen in that game, and it's a great game on a number of levels.
So
to think
let me
that
ask you
just
a question.
Because that little last piece at the end wasn't happy for you, that you should get your money back is asinine to me.
There's two things at work here, I think, and the two things at work are that there are a group of people who are super invested in the fiction and feel cheated by what happened because it didn't marry with their idea of how it should end. And that's the creative difference. And I'm frustrated that people are confusing that with what I think the larger group is upset with it, which is that they did not execute well on the ending. And they didn't execute well on the ending. And who knows why, you know, in having some conversations around, although I really thought that this was outside the realm of possibility, it evidently, you know, due to a number of factors, is conceivable that they could have been really down to the wire and trying to finish the game and had to pull it together that way. I don't think that's as likely as simply the fact that there was so much work put into the journey and so much work put into all the things that you do that it just wasn't coming together and didn't come together for them. But to speak to Dr. Ray's point, I don't know how to tell him this because he's a smarter guy than me also. Like you're talking about with Adam. He's a smarter guy than I am, and those guys are way more creative. But he didn't need to give a statement because all he needed to say was the first part, which is, you know what, fans, you guys are great, and we love that you're really passionate about this. And it's
we stand by our game.
We stand by our game, and it's really – but we put a lot of love into it, and so it hurts us that it didn't work with you. But it is what it is, because I think the big problem really is that they dropped the ball in the execution of the ending. And although it pains me to say this to them, you don't get a redo. I mean, it's
nor should you.
You could, I guess, go back and rework it, but it would just be reworking. It's like one of my favorite movies in the world is Apocalypse Now. And the first time I watched the big Redux version, I was like, man, this is badass. And now whenever I watch it, I'm like, you know, this isn't really Apocalypse Now.
There's a reason they cut that stuff.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
And though you could say, and that's a little different, obviously, because that's adding content in, and it's the mansion, French mansion, which isn't even at the ending. And it's like, obviously, maybe a poor comparison, but you don't really get to go back and redo it. And the more I've thought about it, I guess as time goes on, like their ending, there's some interesting concepts there. They're just not really.
There's some really, really intriguing concepts.
But they're not fleshed out well.
Some of the threads on the forums. I mean, there's one thread about this idea about what the ending really means that's like 800 pages long. It's crazy. And like I said, I brought this booklet with me explaining all of these ideas about what the ending could really mean that maybe the majority of the gamers just didn't get. And then that leads to a bigger problem. If you're creating, you know, this really kind of highbrow, you know, mindfuck twist of an ending that the majority of your audience isn't getting, are you missing the point? You know, did you screw your audience in that way? You know?
I think they get it.
I don't think so.
Oh, I think they get it.
I think
Come
they get
on.
It now that there's like threads about it, but I don't think that you get it right off the bat. I know I didn't. I didn't see that until someone's like, well, look at this and look at this and look at this. This means this. And I was like, I didn't even think about it that way until you pointed it out.
I just think this goes back to the whole product versus art thing. Mm-hmm. The people that are complaining are treating it like a product. Like, I bought this vacuum and it didn't suck up the dirt the way that I wanted
it
to. Or it did suck. Like,
dude, you should have bought a Dyson.
Yeah, right? Right, but I mean...
Or I bought a Dyson and it's not as good as they said. I tried to hook the bowling ball up to it. The shit didn't work.
Yeah, I mean, you can go buy another vacuum cleaner or whatever, but in the case of a game, in the case of a piece of art, a book, a movie, a novel, you know, painting, whatever, I feel pity for BioWare in the sense that they made a game, they put all this hard work into it, and they obviously care about it because they're reacting to the fans in this way. However, I also think it sets a really dangerous precedent. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the fan base at large knows better than BioWare does about making their own art. Really disappointing.
Like, I don't perceive that BioWare is going to go down that road. I think that they're much more interested in trying to satisfy some of the hunger to improve the ending, but without going back and trying to rewrite it.
No,
you know, one of the things that's interesting is it also shows, this also like opens the door to really showing a lot about how the creative process works in a collaborative effort on these big projects. And, you know, I shouldn't say all. I would say there's a large number of folks who liked Matrix and did not like the two Matrix movies thereafter and wondered, did the Wachowskis even have a fucking clue where they were going to go with 2 and 3, or did they just wing that shit and
That's
make it
crazy.
Up with some people?
I made that comparison this morning.
Yeah.
And how I felt that series kind of jumped the shark from what it was happening in the original. And I think maybe some people feel that way about this game.
One of the comments that has been brought up by some of the people who are a little more insidery on this stuff is, well, you know, Drew Karpashian, who wrote 1 and then assisted on 2, left
Isn't
during
the bad
two.
Guy in Ghostbusters 2?
Yes.
Karpashian, yeah.
I hope I am pronouncing his name correctly. Anyway, he went over to Austin to work on Star Wars The Old Republic. And then now he's left entirely and is writing his own stuff. He's done novels as well. And he wrote 3 Mass Effect novels as well. Mm-hmm. But he did not work on Mass Effect 3. And so a lot of folks were saying, oh, well, you know, it's all messed up because Drew's gone and he didn't finish the arc that he wanted to. And he's already defended the ending to a degree on Twitter. He's talked about how, you know, this was a big collaborative effort and this was always BioWare's baby. And it wasn't, you know, as a group, it wasn't his baby. It was everybody's. Like, there was a number of people engaged in it. Now, this is really interesting. He wrote this on his personal blog. He says, of course, some of you are also pinging me to find out what the original ending of the series was when we started planning out the trilogy. Sorry, but that's not something I'm ever going to even attempt to answer. The collaborative creative process is incredibly complicated, and the story and ideas are constantly evolving as you go forward. Yes, we had a plan, but it was very vague. And so there's going to be a vague idea here. So if you're not wanting to even hear a vague idea, now would be a good time to turn down the radio for about 30 seconds.
They listen on radio?
Whatever. A lot of people listen in their cars.
Yeah, oh, it's true.
We knew we wanted to focus on some key themes and bring in certain key elements. Organics versus synthetics, the Reapers, the mass relays. But beyond that, we didn't go into detail because we knew it would change radically as the game continued to evolve. A good example of this is Cerberus. This fucking blew me away. A good example of this is Cerberus. When we wrote Mass Effect 1, Cerberus was basically a throwaway group of pro-human radicals, a name we dropped for some side missions to play the role of villain. We didn't even have a concept of who was running them, and we didn't even think they were that important. Obviously, by the time of my Ascension novel and Mass Effect 2, that had changed radically. The elusive man in Cerberus became central to the story and
because we got Martin Sheen.
Yeah, exactly.
That never would have happened if we had nailed down everything and refused to make changes to the story. What? I mean, that at one time both makes me like, wow, that's awesome that it went that direction. But then also, wait, maybe you should have nailed it down because I don't
natural.
Know.
That's just how stuff gets created.
That's the entire thrust from 2 through to the end is this huge part of this splinter group and how it works. Like,
yeah, but I'm sure they start getting excited about this plot line and then it takes over.
And how long has it been since they started development on Mass Effect 1 to now?
A long time.
I mean, so anybody who writes anything or whatever, you live with material that long, it's going to evolve. Like, yeah. Unless you just put it away.
So how many works do we think of as big holistic works or actually were living works?
Oh, I think all of them. It's much more worrisome to have someone not change their mind.
Yeah.
You know? Right.
Yeah. And there's another concept that I want to bring up.
Tell me the Cerberus thing doesn't blow you away.
It does. No,
I mean, that's
cool.
Just like.
It's very cool, but I think it's you know, par for the course with anything that. You know, is that big of an idea. But there's something I want to bring up at the risk of offending people yet again. But I think that perhaps we as an industry and as a culture at large might need to rethink the whole pre-order, got to have it day one idea. Because our parents' generation didn't live with that. There was no, I bought it the day it came out
really?
For anything.
Have you seen how fast tickets for Hunger Games are selling?
Oh, yeah. But that's our culture now. We got to have it day one. Got to have it day one. I think people are pissed saying, well, I bought this thing having certain expectations. But my dad lived his whole life. You know, he would find out about something before he invested his money in it. And I'm as guilty as that as anybody. I'm not
holier
than that.
Wait, he had Facebook?
No, I'm saying that, you know, movies used to open in a small place and get word of mouth and then open larger and larger as they got better.
Right.
You know, you wouldn't buy a piece of electronics or a car or anything without finding right. out about
but,
it.
But there's such thing as like artist credibility and brand credibility.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know,
sure.
Like Rockstar, I'll take a look at whatever they're doing.
Cause of course.
They've got a great track. BioWare's the same
right.
way.
Right. And like, if you like the first 2 games, you're going to want to get the 3rd game and you're going to have certain expectations about
yeah.
it. But this whole idea that I bought this game day one and it didn't live up to my expectations. Well, you didn't have to buy it day one. You know what I mean? I think that there's maybe a sense of,
well, it's ironic that the people that are going to rush out and buy it day one are the ones that are going to have this like crazy emotional negative response because they're mm-hmm. so invested in the
yeah.
fiction. Like, I need to have this day one and here it is in the end. And what? Ah, rage.
I don't think yeah. that's for everybody, though, because I was one of those people that needed to have it day one, and unfortunately we were at GDC, so I couldn't play it day one, but I was like of that mind frame, like I must have it, I must play it right away, midnight, whatever, right? But I didn't, I mean, I don't know if it was because I was mentally prepared to have something happen at the end because there was so much talk about the ending, but I didn't have that response. Like, I went through the ending of the game, and at when the credits were rolling, I was like, wow, like, that was a really satisfying experience.
Hold on a second.
Was I left with some questions about what happened at the end? Andrea, yeah, of course, but...
Is that a you were genuinely feeling really satisfied?
I'm genuinely saying, like, I had a lot of fun.
And I'm not trying to be a dick. That sounded like a dick. I apologize for sounding like a dick, but...
No, that's a completely valid question, because when I tell people that, they're like, you're not mad at all about this and about this? And what about this? You don't, well, you're not... That doesn't piss you off? And I'm like, well... No, because I honestly believe that those games were more about the journey than the destination.
Totally agree with you about that. Totally agree with you
about the character development.
But I didn't feel
creating those relationships, and I agree that a lot of those were kind of, there was a lot of loose ends, right? Like that's like I think the big complaint is people are like, well, what about what happened with this? What about this? And maybe that's where the DLC comes in.
Well, I think that's, you know? I think you're exactly right. If you read between the lines of what Dr. Ray says, that's the sort of stuff that they're going to go back and talk about. And I think, you know, a couple of so first of all, I am enjoying thinking back about the ending stuff the more I read these things and like those explanations of how they go together and going and thinking and realizing, yeah, there's a lot of cool, you know, some of those things that Drew even spoke to in his explanation on his blog about, which, by the way, curious thing, Drew says he hasn't even played Mass Effect 3. So he's not talking about the ending of the game because he hasn't even played it. Now, that's kind of weird that the guy who like wrote three novels and one and good part of two hasn't even played three, but that's a whole other subject. I'm sure he's very busy working on his original stuff. He's writing his own trilogy now, his own fiction. It's kind of cool.
Exciting.
It's called Blast Eblect.
but I didn't feel, I think it's interesting to use satisfied specifically because I really didn't feel, I felt as it ended, I was like, wait, oh, I mean, that's where I identify with everybody. I'm like, I wanted those other pieces. And I do agree with one of the commenters on Shaq. He said, it's a Snubble 100 who said that if they do this clarity and closure stuff, that it's a good step in the right direction. But then goes on to say, we'll see how it turns out. For me, this ending and how it was conceived. And apparently, and I was looking for a source on this. So this... I hesitate to include this, but I'll just say that they say that the lead writer created the ending without feedback from the rest of the writers, unlike the rest of the series. I couldn't find substantiation for that. So I don't, but that was what I was claiming. Was one of the biggest mistakes the series made.
I do want to say that if I could choose my own ending, I wouldn't have chosen the ending that BioWare gave, because I like my stories to be told a certain way. I like them to end a certain way.
You can't really do that. Tell a story and have it let the user choose their own ending.
But that's what I'm saying. Is like, that's why I still left satisfied, because like, you can't do that. And I appreciate the fact that they had ideas for the way that they wanted their story to end.
So,
and I didn't walk away from that going, God damn you, BioWare, you didn't give me the ending I wanted. You know, I walked away going, I had an amazing time playing these games and having these relationships with these characters, going to these different worlds, you know, learning how to use these different cool powers and, you know, playing with these different squad mates and learning the history of this universe. All of those collectively made up this amazing gameplay experience for me that was not in any way tainted by what happened at the end of that game.
You said taint.
I did.
So damn you, MH Silver, for messing with my head.
Yes. Two things.
One.
Well, if they're going to fix something, here's the two things I want them to fix. Give me my face. I want my face.
I want my face, too.
Give me my retroactively give me my face. Yeah. Secondly, biggest pet peeve of the entire game, which I didn't mention last week, which is the reason that we have red shit come on my view is to show me that I'm close to death because I don't have a life meter on the screen. When I have a life meter on the screen, you don't need to do that.
We've had this conversation before.
Oh, I'm so pissed off.
Yep.
Don't obscure my vision with red blurry shit when I have a life meter showing me that I'm close to death.
That you're
one
angry
or the
about
other.
That.
One or the other.
You're angry about that when we were talking about resistance. That was the last time we would talk about
it. I hate it.
A little voiceover. You are about to die.
Nerd
one
rage
or the
is
other.
So funny.
About to die.
One or the other. other. You don't have, like...
Well, and the thing that I absolutely agree with you in half, I half agree with you, because that red comes when just when your shield
when your
goes
shield
down.
Goes down.
Yes, yeah. I have full health.
So then
not
you
even
pop,
when you're about
then you
to
waste
die.
A unity. You waste a unity, and you're like, well, shit, all I didn't need to use a unity yet. I just lost my shield. Damn.
You
it.
Know why you know that? Because there's a meter on your screen that shows you that information. You have it there constantly, taking up room on your television.
Jeff. Easy boy.
Why do I need blurry screen? To just make it more difficult. When I'm close to death, oh, now there's guys that are on the edge of my vision that
yeah,
I can't
see.
Yeah,
that's perhaps a little over-designed there.
Fuck that. Come on. Yeah.
I'd say there was a playtest.
Give me that. I'll sign that petition. I'm entitled to that.
Yeah, I just want them to make an ending where, like, Shepard flies off into the sunset on a space Pegasus or some shit just to shut everyone
up. That'd be awesome.
Like, space Pegasus. Like...
No, it's like he wakes up and it's like a dude in the 1980s, and he's like, "Wow, whoa. I had the weirdest dream that I was a space captain."
Time to go deliver pizzas.
He's an actual shepherd. Right, yeah. And he like looks, and there's a sheep that kind of looks like a Krogan. Yeah.
No, wait.
And you were there, and you were there?
Dude, there's religious overtones. It's Christmas Day, and he's the shepherd waking up on the hillside above Bethlehem. He looks down there, and he's like, oh, well, I guess I have to go down there now.
That would be awesome. That would be amazing if they like, oh, here's a new ending for you fuckers.
Yeah, yeah. Here's a dozen new endings, you sons of... Making us rewrite it.
Not that I feel that way about any of the people. I just was.
Oh, yeah.
For humorous effect.
Yeah. All right. Well, now that we've cracked ourselves up, let's take a little break. When we come back on the other side, I have to talk a little bit about something M.H. Silva wrote that really frustrated me, but it was accurate, and that's why it frustrated me. Damn it. And then Andrew wants to talk about multiplayer, and then we'll move the hell on for Mass Effect and, you know, come back to it one day. I still want to do a spoiler cast, but I think some people said we should do it soon. I think we should definitely wait for a little while. It's a big game. It's a 40-something hour game. A lot of people playing it. I don't want to turn anybody off. I'd like to do it when we can get you guys who are out there listening, participating.
I must be on this spoiler cast.
Yeah, okay. So
next
so maybe we'll do
appearance.
It. Maybe we'll do it in like 3 or 4 weeks, and we'll let you guys write in and talk about some of the things you'd like to talk about specifically from plot points in the game, and we can really get down to nitty gritty.
We're actually just getting to the point where we can do a spoiler cast about Pac-Man.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Just getting to that point.
Blue Ghosts.
You never know how long it's going to be before people will let you talk about that without being mad.
That's true.
All right. Stick around. We'll be back for the second half of Weekend Confirmed. Coming back, I want to get right into this. M.H. Silver dropped this comment on us, and it sort of, well, it challenged some thoughts that I have, and I'll just leave it at that, and I'll throw this out here. It says, I find it fascinating when I hear people say, I'm going to go full Paragon, or I'm going to go full Renegade when playing games like Mass Effect. To me, it feels like you're undercutting the point of the choice entirely, because you have a mindset going in of, regardless of what's put in front of me, I'm going to choose this one because of some ideal I decided upon before I put the disc in. Obviously, everyone should play the game however they feel, but I have a hypothetical question for those who play this way. There is the narrative option in ME3, which basically auto-plots pilots you through the dialogue. If you could set the game to automatically select Paragon or Renegade options, and maybe you can, I haven't touched it, would you? Because it would basically accomplish the goal you're looking to achieve. Personally, I've always ended up with the morally ambiguous characters in the Mass Effect games, half Paragon, half Renegade, and it was never a plan. I reacted to the choices on screen based on what I felt was reasonable. My Shepard turned out to be like me, caring, understanding, supportive of those closest to him, harsh and abrasive to those who dick him around or disrespect those he cares about. Decisions about killing, politics, and whatnot are mulled over at a time at the time or when those damn trigger icons hit the screen, emotional reactions in the heat of a situation.
I have a very specific thought about this.
Oh, it pisses me off that he said this because he totally broke, put me at odds with two things.
Because,
go ahead.
Because his impulse, I mean, I would think, I mean, for me, would be the right way to play the game.
Yes.
You know, get into the character, play the way you want. The thing is BioWare basically trained players over the first two games to go full Paragon or Renegade because you were penalized for not doing so.
Or rewarded. You were rewarded for being a full badass in One Direction.
That's the problem.
Well, right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But yeah, you couldn't, in order to get some of those dialogue options and plot choices, you had to max one way or the other. Now, when you get to three, where that's not the case.
No, that's still the case. I had grayed out options because I was not enough of something.
Well, no, but they have a, well, I guess they do cater to a morally gray playthrough.
You haven't finished. There are some spots where if you haven't maxed, you
they all come towards like the last, I'd say towards the last like third of the game is where they really start showing up a lot.
Okay, well, that's because you couldn't have possibly gotten that many points up to that point, really.
Okay, so anyway, in summation, that's the key problem is that mechanically it doesn't really. It gives you the option, but it doesn't really encourage that type of gameplay if you are someone who wants to have a certain type of option available to you.
Yes, I completely agree. I unfortunately fault the designers creating this binary system and making it so transparent mechanically.
Yeah.
And I love games, even within the same company, the Dragon Age series, for example, where I can't discern the choice that would be a quote-unquote good guy or bad guy choice.
Yeah, upper right is not always good. Lower right is not always bad.
And I don't get a big number that pops up like, oh, you earned points toward goodness. It's just shades of gray that I'm trying to actually figure out the situation as it comes. And that's how Dragon Age works. That's how a lot of that's how The Witcher works. That's how a lot of the games that I love are built. And I think the point system in and of itself and having a meter that's on your character screen at all times showing you whether you're light or dark just inherently turns it into a video game system that you want to just min-max.
Because you've got a gauge there.
Yeah.
And like you have a gauge and you want to fill the gauge.
And you're awarded by extra dialogue options when you and like,
so here's
I said
the
last
struggle.
Week, like I said last week real quick, the especially with the Paragon options, almost always if you get a special blue Paragon dialogue option, it's a get out of jail free card.
Same with Renegade.
Yeah, it's you can solve both things magically because you had enough points in your thing. So yeah.
So here's my problem is that I am MH Silver when I play most of these games, in that I wind up in that same role of just playing. Like, I want to do that. I want to really role play. I want to role play in the definition of role play. I want to be, projecting into the character and doing all that kind of stuff. But what I've been trying to do with my Shepard specifically was see a different sort of story than I always see, because I feel like I have a propensity to be kind-hearted and be a good guy and want to do the right thing. And, you know, like that's sort of my, like that's my natural proclivity, right? So that's the sort of characters I always create. And yet I know, because there are all these options, that somewhere out there, there is a narrative designer who's creating a different sort of experience in this game.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a part of me in my back of my head that's always saying, man, I'd really like to see that game. I'd really like to see that. I'd really like to know what it is. It's like this. I couldn't sit down, or I wouldn't sit down and write Game of Thrones. I love Game of Thrones, but I would never pull some of the shit that happens. Like, there's stuff I've read in that book where I just wanted to throw it across the room.
Yes.
And yet the fact that I wanted to throw it across the room was really cool because I had gotten so into it. But now when I'm playing a game,
also a great example of the thing we were talking about last segment, which is if it's a egalitarian sort of populist, what do you want? You never get those things that you hate, but you love. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I can think of, yeah, I mean, yeah. Yes. Like, so there is that degree of engagement and excitement, and like, especially the more and more you get wrapped up in it. And I mean, Game of Thrones has been brutal with it. I mean, just brutal. You really buy. It's weird because reading the books, which I need to go back and get back into because I've done through the third one, is the more you get invested in
just brutal.
The more you get invested, like that's why I put it down, because the more you get invested in characters, the more you almost just get desensitized to the fact of like, well, oh my god, it's going to go to hell.
You feel like you're reading history, right? Because anything can happen. Yeah.
So bringing this back to Mass Effect, I almost would like an autopilot go all Renegade because I can't do it. I just couldn't do it. And that was one of the things that was freaking Ariel out, is why I was getting so ticked off at the game, because as Mass Effect 3 ramps up and you're getting into these increasingly grave situations and increasingly, you know, higher stakes on the table, there were points that I just couldn't do the renegade action. Because, and I do sort of fault the script writers here some in that I think that the renegade options in Mass Effect 3 got a little over the top bloodthirsty. There's a lot of.
Does it really change things significantly, or is it just sort of
two
slightly different?
There's a couple decisions that have major impact.
Yeah, there's some cases that aren't renegade. They're just heartless. They're just fucking heartless bullshit. And there's things that you're like, you know what, that could have been solved in a tough person way that wouldn't be Paragon. And that's the other thing, is it forces you to one or the other. Because if you don't do the renegade, then you're doing the Paragon, and now you're getting Paragon points.
You just want your renegade to be the Fonzie.
He's just
a badass, but he's really nice to everybody still.
No, but like there's
hey,
they've
there's
created
nothing wrong
this
with
character
that.
Of Commander Shepard,
hey.
Who at the core is a hero, right? Even if you play Renegade, even if you're like the badass,
yep.
you're still the hero of the Citadel. You're the
yes.
you know, the hero of the that's coming to save the galaxy from the Reapers in the final installment, right? At the core of who Commander Shepard is, or who we've come to know this general Commander Shepard to be, regardless of how you play your Shepard, I don't think that Shepard would make some of the choices that you can make
yep.
in the game.
I agree.
I think there some of them are really terrible choices.
So that auto... I agree with that 100%. That's a really good way of putting it. And that's why having that autopilot mode would almost be interesting, because I couldn't do it, but I really am... I'm curious to see how they resolve some of those choices that would be really hard like that as they wrap up the narrative, because there would be some shit that would be really hard to resolve and really, really interesting to resolve. And I'd love to see those things, but I just can't bring myself to do them as a player. And so, yeah, actually I would like that, but then he's right. I mean, this whole like idea of going in, you know, with I'm going to be all Paragon or I'm gonna be all Renegade it sort of breaks it. But at the same time, that's the only way to go see those other sides of the narrative experience.
I really don't think you could go in and be all Renegade, because just talking to people gives you Paragon points. Like just going around the Normandy between missions and talking to the people on the Normandy just automatically gives you Paragon points.
So just don't
points.
Talk to them.
Yeah, I guess just don't talk to anybody. Just never go see the people on your ship ever.
I just don't know. I just think it's less interesting to be, you know, the Boy Scout or the megalomaniacal douchebag.
Yeah.
It's so much more interesting to say like, well, there's bad things on both sides of this, you know, mm-hmm. make a decision where you're screwing over somebody or there's, you know,
and
that's
part of
so
it's
much
the
more interesting.
Part of it's the nature of the decisions they give you too, because some right. of them aren't, some of them are so black and white that you're just like, okay, well,
yeah. There, you want to save
there's
these
no, like,
people
what is
or kill
the,
them?
What is, yeah, exactly. What is the right thing to do doesn't really crop into your mind. It's like, okay, am I going to be a good or a total dick, you know?
All right, Andrea, what's your take on multiplayer? Because you wanted to talk about multiplayer some.
I did. And multiplayer, I have to say, if you guys have not tried it yet and you have Mass Effect, you should absolutely try it.
Why do you have hearts on your notes, by the way?
I was doodling. I was inspired. Yes.
So much.
I mean, obviously, before the game came out, when multiplayer was first announced for Mass Effect, there was a lot of, you know, up in arms about that as well, because, you know, the Mass Effect fans are very passionate people. And I think that they have done a really great job with it. There's a couple things about it that I'm not such a fan of.
Like it's not balanced.
Well, yes, but I mean, a lot of multiplayers have trouble with balance in their when they first
saying.
Come out. Like that's just a multiplayer issue across the board, especially when you don't do Okay, I mean, I guess it's arguable to say that they did an extensive beta, but I don't think it was that extensive, just for multiplayer. But what I really love about the game is how you get invested in each of these classes and each of these characters.
Oh, yeah.
And how, at least from my experience playing with my friends on Xbox Live, it's always like, all right, so who's going to be the Sentinel and who's going to be the Adept and who's going to play as the Vanguard this match? You know, we all like take roles. I've never played a match where everyone's like, I'm going to do my own thing and be my own thing. It really is a cooperative experience, and it's hard. Like, it's out the gate. Like, if you don't have a strategy or you don't know, you know, how to use your powers or combine, do the combos with certain powers, like, it's tough. Even on bronze level, it can be really challenging, which I appreciate that BioWare kind of didn't just make it super easy out the gate. So I really like that. But I will say that I was really kind of thrown back by the microtransactions that appeared right away in the game. I mean, you're spending $60 to buy the disc. If you are buying it used, like for $50 or $40, or you're borrowing it for a friend, or you're renting it on Gamefly, you have to pay for the online pass to get into the multiplayer. So that's on another $10 on top of however much you're paying to play the game. And then, in order to even have a fighting chance to upgrade your weapons, and you have to buy these packs that cost anywhere from $1 to $2 or thousands of credits that you earn in the game.
Or you could just play the game. I haven't had any credit problem. I've made plenty of money playing multiplayer.
Oh, no, you definitely make money. But what I'm saying is, like, if you want to get to those, if you don't want to wait for the first 20 levels to go into silver or even into gold, you almost have to buy the packs.
I'm curious that it upset you, because I think it's... I think that my initial response was, oh, that's shitty. They're just trying to get people, because their card system in soccer and stuff, and it's been the same way with their ultimate cards. But the money comes in so fast playing this game that it's clear that it's more like a microtransaction model from free-to-plays, where it's an accelerator.
Well, you know what? And that's what I'm saying. At first, I was really hesitant against it. And then I kind of I ended up spending $5 just to buy the packs to see what you get. But my gripe about it is, I've always been a pro free-to-play, pro microtransaction person, saying if you want to pay, you should be allowed to pay. However, with this specific instance, if you buy something, it's not like you get it all the time. They have expendables, which I've never seen in a game before. I'm sure it exists somewhere, but I personally have never indulged in a in a microtransaction situation where I would buy something and then only get to use it one time, and then poof, it's gone. Like the weapon, the ammo upgrades, and some of the expendable, like the rockets and the medigels that you buy, and then once you use it, it's gone. It's one thing if you buy a weapon and it's unlocked permanently, or a weapon skin and it's unlocked permanently. But they're asking for your money, and they're saying, oh, you get to use it this one round, and that's it. That, to me, is a problem. I don't like that at all.
I'm kind of with you on that, actually. That's
so don't buy it. I mean, it's an accelerator. I understand what you're saying.
I know, but you don't... I personally did not understand that until after I had bought the pack, and then that I equip my cryo ammo that I just paid for and got in my veteran pack, and then I equip it, and then I go to equip it the second round, and it's like, oh, it's gone. You used it the first round. And I was like, wait a minute, what? I don't get that unlocked? I thought there was going to be a leveling system like there is in the actual game. Your cryo ammo, your incendiary, they all have, you can upgrade them.
Well, I think that's an interesting balancing move
that they made. I didn't like that at all.
None of the ammo types are upgrades that you get through your character. They're all per use.
They're not skills.
They're not skills items, anymore. So. Right. They're add-ons that you take in per match.
And then not only that, you don't get to choose what's in the pack. So nope. I literally bought two packs and got the same gun in both packs. And I was like, I just got buying magic cards.
But wait,
did you dual wield?
Didn't you get an upgrade for one of them? Would have been an upgrade, right?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think you would have had... Yeah, because there are levels, which becomes increasingly important as you go up. Is like, if you get the same gun, the first one will be, a hammer level 1. The next one will be hammer level 2.
Yeah, okay, I guess I need to go back and check that. But I was pissed the first time I saw that. But I know if you get the same character, you get extra bonus, experience or whatever.
Oh,
right?
Man. If they could, put that model into Call of Duty...
That's exactly what I thought. Activision hasn't done this yet?
When they do it? Yeah, I mean, only $5 per grenade, kids.
Yeah.
Whatever.
But you're still denying the point that I made off the bat, which is that I was initially reviled by the whole thing, and then I realized, shit, just playing the game, I'm not having any problem making the money I need to buy. I was buying packs right and left, but with in-game currency. I haven't spent a penny on it. I haven't spent a penny. And I don't have any plans to spend a penny on it, because you earn money... You totally earn money fast enough to feed that if you're playing.
I mean, you do earn a decent amount, especially if you're playing with people who are really highly leveled up. You level up faster because they gain more experience for the group or whatever at the end. But I don't know. I felt almost like I had to level up my character through those packs.
Really?
And to get the best guns, to have the shot, to even have a fighting chance at doing one level on gold, you have to get Spectre packs.
Yes.
That's just what you have to do.
But if you're playing silver, you're going to earn enough to get a Spectre pack probably every 3 matches.
Dun, 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 dun. Spectre pack. Dun, 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 dun.
Have you not played any of the multiplayer?
I haven't.
I'm moving this week. I'm lucky to have played.
He has built three IKEA things
with my own hands,
which is impressive. But I will say that
a lot of important looking shit still left.
Playing
over,
the multiplayer and then going back to the campaign made me a better player in combat because I knew how to deal with specific enemies better.
Oh my god, it feels slow.
Yeah, it does. It does. I was like, Banshee, oh, I got you. You're dead.
Although they definitely ramp the difficulty of those characters up a lot in multiplayer. Like,
oh my
Banshees
gosh, yeah.
Banshees are ridiculous.
In multiplayer, yeah.
Ridiculous.
They're terrible. And the brutes are really hard in multiplayer, too.
All right, we've officially talked about Mass Effect too long.
Yes. Okay.
I've decided that.
All right.
What else we got?
We're done talking about Mass Effect. Should we talk about Mists of Pandaria?
Pandaria.
All right, so talk about wanting to be something for everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, okay, so...
But that's, I mean...
It seems like a two-pronged attack.
Yes.
You know, one for the... Some nods for the hardcore community, people that have been playing forever or maybe want to come back, and then a bunch of stuff that is largely optional that is, you know, seems very casual friendly.
Very casual friendly.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty clear they looked at the MMO space and went, there's a lot of competition for... The hardcore. There's a lot of people. There's Star Wars is in the world and 12 other MMOs that are on the horizon. There's a lot of people chasing the same people. But we have hit such a critical mass of knowledge of what our product is and sort of acceptance. You know, people's girlfriends and wives and grandmothers. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are more open to WoW than they have ever been.
Yep.
Why not give them something to get excited about and broaden the audience rather than chasing the same, you know, 11 million people we've already got.
As long as we're going to talk about Mists of Pandaria, you guys should laundry list it so everyone knows what the hell we're talking about.
Well, this was a 2-hour presentation that was basically an info dump of Titanic proportions.
Yeah, it was literally like
a data fire hose.
Yeah, it really was.
That was the quote from John LeGrove, the lead producer.
There's tons of stuff.
All right, I will rock through it for you then, since I happen to have it in my brain up here.
Well, I got it in my brain too.
All right, well then do it.
Well, we got pandas.
Yeah, pandas.
You can play as pandas.
Monk class. Yep.
They stepped through what are now 9 new zones in the expansion. It used to be 7. Now there are 9.
Correct.
And all of them look really pretty.
Yeah, they do, and they're all based on, so they have sort of a Pan-Asian influence, so there's, you know, areas that kind of feel like Mongolia or Vietnam or China or, you know, very specifically, but not to the point where you're like, oh, I'm in China.
Yeah. Jeff Kanata, here's the question that Jeff Mattis wasn't sure he knew the answer from, and I wanted to see if you actually were able to glean this from their discussion. So if I understand correctly, when you start a Pandarian, then you start a panda,
yep,
it's neutral.
Yes. So, and then at the end of your 10 levels, I think, you choose a side.
Okay, that's what I wasn't sure of, is when do you choose a side? When do you go Horde or Alliance?
I said 10 levels. I think that's what it is, but it could be earlier.
That sounds correct, if I remember from BlizzCon.
Yeah, I just remember that after level 60 is when the first patch hits, where, you know, Horde and Alliance armor sort of roll up on the beach of Pandaria.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, that's what I initially thought was when you'd make the decision, because that's when the war actually comes to the...
How does a patch hit after you hit a certain level?
Well, it's instanced. So, like, you hit...
So it's not a patch, but that's
I'm
you
sorry.
Won't hit that instance until...
They have to build that in. They have level 1 through 60 content in this initial release, and the first patch will incorporate...
I'm not following what you're saying. You're saying when you start as a panda from level 1, right?
Yes. Correct.
You play through the starting area, which is that giant turtle back.
Yep.
And then I think at the end of that, when you move to the
I wasn't 100% clear on when that demarcator was.
I'm fairly certain it's when you leave the turtle. When the turtle arrives at the mainland of Azeroth, then you have to decide whether you are, who you know, you're either with us or against us. So then, you're either Alliance or Horde. Yeah.
All right.
Okay. That makes
and
sense.
And then there's a whole new continent there, or the continents on the back of the turtle?
There's just like the other patches or the other expansions that have introduced new races, they've got new starting area for those races. But then from level, 10 through 85, you're
90.
No. Through 85, you're doing the shit that's already existed. You're doing all the stuff that's been out.
Okay.
Then 85 to 90.
So there'll be
these 9 new areas.
So there'll be pandas running around the barrens.
Absolutely.
Fucking bizarre.
Well, no, that's, I mean, that's, yeah, that's how it is.
Just Thousand
like
needles.
Were, just like there were werewolves again around the Barrens for a while.
God, there's
and then the
85
to 90 content is really what they focused on in this presentation, because mm-hmm. that is all this, as you said, Pan-Asian, very Chinese temple, you know, all the way to.
So
like,
wait, 85 to 90 is someplace else also?
No.
85
that's
to 90
the fight
is
comes
the,
to Pandaria, right? That's what, I mean, from what I've seen of it, like that was the whole thing with this expansion, is that there's this peaceful place where these pandas live, the Pandarins live or whatever, and then Pandaria. the Alliance and the Horde come there and invade that place.
And it upsets the Shah.
Well, it's been obscured by the mists part. Oh, there's this new island we didn't know about. It's just explaining why there's now an island.
Yeah.
Which is what the pandas had hopped off of.
Yeah, but
when
it's,
they first
it's
there.
The same as Northrend or any of the other expansion islands that weren't there when the free game first came out. It's like, oh, new area, and that'll get you from 85 to 90, right?
Okay.
So, 9 new dungeons. They look really, really crazy and cool. Like, they showed this Storm Keg Brewery or Storm Something Brewery.
Yeah. No, I don't remember the exact specifics.
Down, but.
Yeah, but it was a brewery, and they're also these dungeons have exteriors where you can be questing in the world and see the dungeon, and you'll have some missions that will take you to, you know, areas around and sort of in and through the dungeon, but that won't actually put you in the main dungeon.
So here's one of the first things that popped to mind for
Storm
me.
Storm Stock Brewery.
Oh.
One of the first things that popped to mind for me was expansion packs, by their nature, seem to more cater to the existing WoW players than new players. And admittedly, this is the one that they want to use to try to bring new players in. However, you want to get all of you, as many as possible of your core players in it as well. And it just seemed to me that only upping the level cap by 5 levels this late in the game is a pretty small, pretty marginal change.
It's a ton of content.
Yeah.
It is a
It seems
ton
like a pretty
content.
Marginal change. I was surprised that, you know, look, they're late. They are late in the game. They are losing subscribers. They have core people who are slowing down and or dropping out entirely, and to only say 85, like the thing that happens when an expansion comes out and a level cap changes is who's the first person to get to the new level, and it's a race and everyone wants to do it. If it's only 5 levels, it's like,
well,
five
there
levels.
Was only 5 levels last time as well. And
I know.
It was a shit ton of content.
Shit ton of content is fine, but the way people think of it is it's only 5 levels. I was surprised that given where they are, given the erosion of player base that they're having, that they didn't say, we're going to 100.
Well, I think that kind of misrepresents the idea here. And I think the way they framed it, which is, I think, a very conscious decision on their part, is, hey, look, it looks light and fluffy. It looks like a much gentler tone than Cataclysm or Wrath of the Lich King were. Yeah. That's a very conscious decision on our part. We know we got 2 more expansions already in the pipeline. Those are going to be super dark.
Really?
That's what they said. They said, this is just a breath of fresh air before the super dark stuff. And the really interesting thing is, for endgame content, they thought of this as, with Wrath and with Cataclysm. So Cataclysm, big dragon's on his way, right? Everybody mm-hmm. knows big dragon's on his way. You buy the expansion, you don't get to fight big dragon. Big dragon is coming, but you don't get to fight him until 2-3 patches down the line. So they, and that's the way it's always been, is they right. planned it out so that there's an arc of a cycle of these patches, which are free, but continue where the expansion left off and continue the big main storyline, and you end up fighting the big bad at the end of the 3rd patch. They changed their philosophy this time with Pandaria, and they're having the story cycle conclude at the end of the expansion end game content, and then a new story start up with the first patch that's for that expansion, which I think is a really interesting idea. We'll see how it plays out. Mm-hmm. But they thought, you know, that's kind of a tease of there's this big bad. We're not doing a big bad this time.
Yeah.
There's no big bad. It's just this interesting story
there's
that's
an
gonna
arc.
Cycle through.
And if you get this, you got the full arc, and when we get to the end of it, we've got a patch coming. They'll have a new beginning for something else.
Yeah. And I also think that there was a lot of attention paid to doing things that are different than just leveling and item collecting. You know, most of the time you're just leveling up and getting new items and expansions, and they added mini games.
Yeah, basically. And they
pet you know, fights
for their most part look pretty fun.
Really fun.
Yeah.
I got really excited. I mean, it's very consciously Pokemon or Final Fantasy kind of look.
So,
to
okay.
It.
So you said you got very excited. Are you?
Yeah.
How likely are you to come back to World of Warcraft who hasn't played it for a while, but
I always come back when the expansions happen. I've done it every time. I don't know how to resist it. I don't know how. I mean, and there's a complete overhaul of the talent system. Huge, massive changes.
Really? Okay. I didn't know about that part.
System.
Streamlining, really. Simplification. You know, so you're not like when you come in with a super high level dude and you have to reassign all your skill points. You're not like, oh my God, I got to pull out these Excel spreadsheet and research these things and figure out how to correctly build my character. You're, what is it, six levels of.
Yeah, every 15 levels you get a talent decision, and they really are looking at it as a completely different approach. Before, there's these talent trees, and you go, oh, I want to be, you know, a specific spec of my guy. I want to be restoration, whatever. There's usually a quote-unquote correct way to play that spec, which is the most efficient people, you know.
That's always was one of my complaints of Endgame. Wow.
Me too. And I think that's one of their complaints is they don't like the fact that you go on to what's the
Thoughtbot? Is that still a thing?
Yeah, I was going to say that. What's the guys, the pretentious bastards or whatever they're called? It doesn't matter. Anyway, so you find the most efficient spec, and that's pretty much what you do. Right? Yeah. You just plug and play.
Right.
Well, they wanted to really give people a choice, viable options where there's not one spec that's the right spec. There's just play style variation that you can cater to how you like to play. So the end result of that is that you get fewer decisions because it's only one every 15 levels,
right,
which I have mixed feelings about. And you get three options each time. And all of them sort of, from what I could tell, I looked just at the Paladin, which is my character.
Yeah, I just kind of
that I play
through
most.
Him a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious what you think about this, because I have very mixed feelings about it. Because it looked like you basically get one active skill and two passive skills per decision. So you get three decisions, or three things you can decide among, and one of them is an active skill and two of them are passive. And they sort of do variations on the same theme.
Yeah, exactly. There's the same. So you're not... I think that sort of goes to their intent not to make people have buyer's remorse somewhere down the road where you're like, well, I didn't, you know, I had three options and they're all sort of, you know, I can sort of, play the way I want to, even if maybe I selected one of them incorrectly.
My worry is that they're all sort of accomplishing the same goal in just slightly different ways.
Oh, they probably, I can't confirm that. I mean, obviously,
we
need to spend some time with it, but that could be the case.
I don't know. Did you get... I was of two minds about it because it's an exciting goal, but I worry that it just – in order to accomplish that goal, you just have to sort of whitewash everything and it becomes less interesting overall.
If they're really trying – which it seems like they are – really trying to pull in new and even more casual players, simplifying systems like that really don't benefit anyone except the core wiki readers, like I'm going to go and figure out what my build is and, you know – I think that's going to be a good thing for them. I think obviously there's going to be some folks who aren't, you know, initially happy about it. But I don't know that it's really going to change the experience that dramatically. It's just another one of those systems that they've refined for people who are maybe like, ooh, pandas, cool. Yeah.
So, Jeff, you're back.
I likely will be.
I got a beta invite.
I'm
hopping
check
in?
It out. Yeah, yeah.
You sound weird. You have the weirdest reaction to WoW.
I know it's a hard
Jeff Mattis
thing.
I'm not really.
Did you feel any appeal there? Did you feel any pull of the panda?
I'm not really it's not even WoW per se. It's I'm just not much of an MMO guy.
Should we wake Andrea up now?
I'm listening. Trust me, the pandas actually made me contemplate getting into WoW.
You're the target audience.
Really?
I know. Totally am. Because I'm not like an MMO person, but I was like, hey, they're not like ugly trolls. They're cute.
Oh,
I totally
God.
Just put myself into a stereotype, and I totally know that.
I'll let you dig yourself out of that when we come back on the other side of this and make the charge to finishing moves in the final segment of Weekend Confirmed coming up after this break.
EA suggests that you remake your face. EA suggests that you remake your face.
Fuck that. Stole my face. A hired gun stole my face with painkillers and a 9mm on it.
Glass of scotch.
Fuck that.
Kind of sucks. I'm starting off on this.
Glass of scotch.
Fuck that.
People gave us shit for being poopy pants.
Fuck that.
Poopy pants.
Stole my face. Face.
Face.
Face.
Face.
Fuck that.
I'm not being renegade, but.
Fuck that.
Yelled renegade.
Renegade! 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 Face.
Fuck that.
Because we were sort of poopy pants.
We were sort of poopy pants. Another classic there. Hey, no Del Rio here today. He's actually left us on our own. That's kind of amazing, isn't it?
Talk about the inmates running the asylum.
I know,
when the
right?
cat's away, the mice will play.
And I have to say that my cynicism was obviously misplaced because during the break, the Mists of Pandaria was getting great conversation here. You guys are obviously, like, Jeff's reinterested in WoW. Mattis is, like, engaged, even though he's not super into it. And Andrea is sitting here telling us about how between pet battles and
farms.
Pandas and farms.
Farm.
She's interested in checking it out.
And you can raise a flying dragon mount from an egg.
Yeah.
That's pretty rad.
All
right, so obviously they have some idea what they're doing because it seems to be getting attention again, which is I think that's the first step of what they needed to do. You know, they've had a lot of maybe over the top negativity because it's like, hey, they're still 10 million strong. Just because they're not 13 million doesn't mean that 10 million is something to laugh at.
Right.
And so they're obviously putting a lot of work into this. And I think that the one thing they're doing that I thought, and you guys haven't even mentioned it, is the challenge dungeons.
That's very cool. They've already sort of had that with the achievements, but the fact that you actually have leaderboards now.
Yeah.
And that it's not tied to actual loot that will change your stats. It's just a cosmetic loot. I think it's very smart.
So what I like about that is that for the person who plays a good bit but doesn't want to go down the PvP rabbit hole of mastering PvP builds and PvP strategies, now you can be a cool PvE player and have something cool to brag about.
Yeah.
And maybe not even just brag about, but like there's the competitive piece. It brings a competitive piece in, but lets you stick to viewing your PvE part, which is what you're into, and have that analogous experience to the PvP competition layer, which if you weren't into PvP before was all sort of lost on you. Which was a lot of it.
Having said that, the PvP stuff they showed was rad. They basically,
what did they show
Indiana
for PvP?
Jones in the Temple of Doom kart racing scene level. The mine cart level.
When was that? When did they show that off?
During the PvP section. You have the two cart where you can like attack the switch and you can switch the cart.
Yep, it was
all elevated. Tracks like in freaking Indiana Jones.
Yeah, so you have basically a minecart that you're trying to get to your base.
Yeah,
and
so cool.
There are toggles along the track, and you're like fighting dudes while you're trying to basically redirect this cart. It's pretty neat.
So rad. And there's like oddball. They added oddball basically. Mm-hmm. What is ostensibly oddball?
There is no shortage of MMO properties out there, and this next story was one that when I saw I had to include in the show today because it's been such an interesting ride for this MMO. It's Vanguard Heroes Saga, and the game has had quite a saga. And if you're not familiar with it right off the bat, this is the game that was done by Sigil Entertainment, who were formed by Brad McQuaid, who was the lead designer for EverQuest, legendary, put together like this super team to make this game.
Wouldn't be Sigil? It's Sigil?
Sigil?
I would think it'd be Sigil. But
yeah. Sigil?
Sigil.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry.
I'm bad at pronunciation.
No, I didn't mean to sidetrack you there. Go ahead.
Emphasizes on the wrong syllable.
Yeah. Anyway, this game was legendary because originally it was signed by Microsoft. And Microsoft did the publishing deal, and it was when they were, pushing on, they were going to do this big, massive, everything we learned from EverQuest to make this fantastic game. Had a lot of excitement and enthusiasm behind it because that at that time, also, we were still in that age of people coming out of EverQuest and EverQuest 2 and talking about how, WoW is cool, but they didn't like the visuals. They didn't like, the cartoon style. They wanted a serious high fantasy MMO, which this promised to be. And then it got very troubled. Infamously, there were all kinds of implications as it crashed and burned of what might have been going on at the studio and, some personal struggles for McQuaid. And, long story short is SOE wound up picking up the game and, by all intents and purposes, kicked it out the door at the end. Right when the game came out, it had, along with having a number of problems, when you got to high level content areas, you could be wandering around the world and it was empty.
Whoa.
Yeah, because it was like just
No mobs even?
Like no mobs. There was just unfinished stuff. There was literally unfinished stuff. Now, they'd done a little bit of work, but they haven't done anything on it for a long time. And lo and behold, this is one of those games that now I thought I was actually, when I saw this news, I was like, wait, that's still turned on? And yeah, not only is it turned on, they're taking it free to play this summer and now promising content updates.
As in to finish the stuff that was not finished?
No, evidently. So a lot of that stuff was finished. Ah. So, I think that their populations, though, had dropped down into the tens of thousands. They're down to like one consolidated server, which is sort of interesting, I guess, if you like the whole idea of everyone playing on one shard, the Eve thing. And I'm just curious, you know, what do you guys, does that get you interested, excited? Do you guys think of anything about that? Like the idea of a super hardcore MMO, high fantasy.
Well, there's a lot of super hardcore MMOs, aren't there?
That was like the ultra, it's essentially the ultra premium MMO of 2007, now reduced to, yeah, we're going to come out and we're going to do free play. And hopefully you'll come back.
It seems like that's the
and SOE's been successful
plan for a lot of games.
Yeah,
it's just like
I've heard that song.
When
before.
In doubt, free to play. Which is, hey, I ain't complaining.
Hey, no, actually, I tried a lot of games that I probably wouldn't have ever played because of free to play. But yeah,
I mean, I think I don't have any specific ties to that property, nor does it sound particularly compelling to me. But I love the fact that I could try it for free if I wanted to.
All right.
I'm all for that.
All right, so over in Iceland right now, the EVE Fan Fest is going on. Did you keep up with any of that stuff?
Dude, EVE is the game that I wish I could play.
No, do you really wish you could play, or are you just more interested in checking it out?
I wish there was a version of me that was the guy who dug that stuff.
That's not a game, though. That's a lifestyle.
Yeah.
It really is. It's.
Yeah. I sort of, from like, afar, well, admire it.
Yeah, it can be, but EVE's pretty even crazy.
More, like, it's even more crazy. It's hardcore, man. It's cool. Alex got into that for a long time and told me a lot about it, but
really?
Yeah, he did for a little while. Yeah,
that was unexpected.
I don't have the temperament for that game, you know.
Oh, me either.
But I sort of wish I did.
So I talked. Did you talk to them at all at GDC? Because they were talking
the
about
EVE
Dust.
Guys?
Well, they were talking about Dust 514.
Oh right, yeah.
Which is one of the big things that they're showing off. They have the first playable here, and this is a really interesting crossover that goes a little deeper. They started to like take some of the wraps away to show how this is going to work. So. Dust 514 is a shooter. It's built on Unreal Tech, I think.
I believe that
it's not CryEngine, right? It's Unreal
no,
Tech.
No, it's not CryEngine.
We could look it up real quick and make sure. But it's built on one of those engines that looks pretty and dark and all that kind of stuff. But here's where it starts to come together for them in this idea that PlayStation 3 players in Dust 514 will be playing mercenaries who can be hired by EVE operators in EVE the MMO to help their faction or their corporation take over important strongholds on planets inside the EVE universe.
I think conceptually that is a very cool idea.
It's really
very
fucking
cool idea. I tend to find that in practice, a lot of that kind of stuff... It's kind of like what we were talking about last week with the RTS commander mode where you have a real person giving the orders and then real people execute.
But there's no RTS commander mode in this.
I understand that.
Now, one thing they have shown today in the live stream of the video conference was that – so the way they're going to have this thing set up is when you're playing Dust 514, you'll like go into the Merc base, and the Merc base will have a assignments board. Think of it almost like the monster trophies in Final Fantasy games where they have, you know, like the hunter board.
Yeah.
So they'll have like a hunter's board. You'll go in there. There'll be the contracts being offered from live players. And when you take one, then you'll have an agreement with them. Now, your hiring person can be on station above planet and provide you some support. So you could be assaulting a base where you need to get in and steal some data, so to say, which that's one of the things that they showed. And you could, when you get close, call in a orbital bombardment from your partner or from your hiring person to help you make the assault. And eventually, the one thing they do want to do is they want to eventually get to a point where they have avatar level interactions so that instead of going to a board, you would actually be, say, like going up to the spaceship with an avatar and going and talking to someone who's playing an EVE, the PC version, the MMO game, and getting your assignment and then going back down to the ground and having this ground fight.
That would be super cool.
It is cool. The thing that confuses me the most, and it didn't confuse me when I first saw early stuff on it last year's E3, is that I just don't know why they decided to opt with PS3 for the platform for the shooter part of it, because there's a sort of just a natural, you know, demarcation line or fracture between, you know, the hardcore PC EVE players and those that play games on the PS3. Now, I know there's obviously crossover there, but it would just seem like you're creating another barrier for a new complicated system that you really just want people to flood into and play. Like, you don't want, you know, you don't want this thing to be empty for, you know, 3 months, because then it'll die. Like if nobody's down there playing the ground combat side of things.
So, two things. Number one, you're probably never going to have to worry about no one playing the ground combat thing, because EVE corporations are so well organized and are so you know,
they assign dudes to go
buy a PS3.
Not only will they assign dudes, that's already happened. There are already mercenary organizations that have been assembled from people who are going to be the hotshot mercenaries to be for hire for this game. So it's going to create keep in mind,
that's
this whole weird society that happens there's this whole social experiment that happens in Eve.
Right.
And this mercenary community is going to be a part of it, which if you hadn't thought about it, it already is a part of it because that society already exists. So we're on the outside looking in and thinking, oh, well, who's going to go play this?
Yeah.
And they're already planning out mercenary squads to be the people to go do that.
Oh, yeah, no.
If there's a game to do this.
Let me give you the rest because the question, to answer your question. So the rest of the answer to your question is their deep concern was if they went hardcore PC shooter, that would be a walled community because they would be so hardcore that they would have all those hardcore PC players who would be populating the shooter part of the game, mm-hmm. that it wouldn't serve the purpose that they want it to, which is to allow people who aren't super hardcore Eve guys to also feel like they can come play it.
I guess it will all depend on how much Dust, the 514, stands alone as a solid, if you're a casual player or whatever, somebody who doesn't play the PC Eve and pick it up, it has to be fun, it has to be engaging, it doesn't have to be like, okay, wait, I'm part of...
Spreadsheet.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, because...
But if you, how would it? It doesn't have anything to do with that. That's the point, is it is strictly Unreal shooter.
But
you go in, you accept a contract, and you go take your mission and go run your mission.
That's my worry, is that it's sort of a servant of two masters, because when you describe it as an extension of what people are already doing, it gets really thrilling of this, as you say, a social experiment, which is what Eve already is, and the idea that they could just branch out and all that stuff, super cool. My concern is, and I think I'm a little jaded in the sense of seeing these kinds of gameplay mechanics tried before, is that from a casual person's perspective, in absence of this sort of avatar walking around actually talking to a human being, what you get as an end user from a casual perspective is no different than a video game where that's not an actual human being asking you for something. If you're just
I disagree. I totally disagree.
If you're just going to a board and looking at a job listing and selecting it, and it's not like Journey. It's not like the knowledge that that's an actual human being asking you to do that.
Well, it's not trying to be Journey. That's a bit of a harsh comparison.
But what I'm saying is that in Journey, there could be a situation in which an AI companion would give you a sort of certain stimuli that are similar.
Right.
And my knowledge that it's a real person is additive. I know that it's a real person and therefore it adds something to the experience. Knowing it's a real person posting a job listing on a board doesn't really change anything.
Yeah, that's,
it doesn't really.
I agree with that.
I think you're both missing the point.
What's the point?
I think it'll be really, cool if it works. Which
I agree,
is that,
it's cool.
Is that if I'm a shooter player, I can go play any shooter and be listed on a leaderboard, and a leaderboard eventually goes away and no one gives a shit. But if I go into Dust 514 and I'm a really good shooter player and I just want to play the shooter part, there are going to be real people sitting on message boards and on Twitter and on Facebook recruiting me and trying to get me to come work for them because they're crazy and fucking psycho about their corporations and they want their corporation to be successful. And suddenly my ability to play that game is really, really, really a big deal because they want me to come play
for
them.
You're arguing for the hardcore.
Yeah,
and I'm saying for
the
hardcore.
But that's not
awesome.
For the hardcore.
What did you say? You just said if I'm awesome on top of the leaderboards, people are going to want me.
Dude, there are people. Think about this like this. How many people are there playing Call of Duty every day?
Thousands.
Okay.
Yeah. No, not the age.
More than 12? Oh. Yeah.
And the rewards that they get are leaderboards and some mutual admiration inside the Call of Duty community. Here is going to be a big community of all these hardcore MMO players who are going to be crazy fucking nuts for how well they're doing in this. Who are going to be out there
disagreeing with
recruit.
What you're saying. I'm saying none of that neither is of the casual market.
Yeah, neither of us are disagreeing. I just...
Right.
So Call of Duty isn't casual?
No.
I don't know if
I would not say Call of Duty is a casual game that you can just jump into. Like, the people that play, the people that are good, that can compete in Call of Duty play, I'd say at least 3 to 5 times a week.
I'm just saying that what
at a hardcore level, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of people playing that are just playing Call of Duty to have fun.
Right, but what Dust offers over and above that isn't for the casual, you know what I'm saying? What their differentiator here is really awesome for the people that are super into that universe and can coordinate with, you know, Eve players and so on. That's
but there's
awesome.
Nothing. But there's nothing to coordinate.
Okay, I mean, I think we're kind of talking in circles.
Yeah,
so
I mean, you know, you've got. I don't know. I think I've said what I need to say about it. It's
cool.
It is very, very cool. Don't get me wrong.
I'm just worried that it won't
It's a different reward loop, and it's a human reward loop that I think that after hearing them explain it and talk about it, it sort of clicked with me of like, wow, that could be really interesting. Like if I just want to play, if I want to play a shooter, getting like a real contract from someone who's a real person and then them being excited about me being successful is kind of cool. And then the other side of it is like when we lose.
I don't think anyone's saying that that's a bad thing.
I just think that your experience logging on as a PlayStation 3 player and going, oh, I'm going to do this mission, and I did it. I don't think the fact that a human being posted that mission is substantially different.
Well, there may be other things that make you feel like you're part of a larger war, but
yeah.
But you know, in that sense, I don't know what you could
do. I agree in the sense that I don't think the players are going to put that much more stock in grabbing a mission off of a job board, knowing that somebody else posted it there. I think it's a mission off of a job board. They're going to want to do the mission regardless of who created the mission.
It's like,
and when they're successful, they're not going to be at all excited that someone was like really happy that they were successful and posted it around.
Are those people going to have an interaction?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that part.
Well,
like what's that interaction consist of?
That interaction consists of you accepting a contract from them.
I mean, do you talk to this person?
Well, they were talking about trying to explore cross-platform voice chat. Like,
well, they're not going to do voice chat.
Yeah,
they're not going to do it because it's rife with.
So basically, you're just sending text messages.
You'll be
back
sending
and forth.
Text messages back and forth.
I just know that the experience that I had playing Mag,
but that's not the point.
But like when I played Mag,
yes.
And granted, I know I had a very hardcore audience, and that was awesome for them. When I was very much a more casual player of Mag,
mm-hmm.
going into what was a 200 player chaos craziness.
Right.
But what was happening for me, my experience was that me and 8 other dudes were doing this one thing. There was tons of other shit happening somewhere else that I wasn't privy to, other than on a map was going, oh, there's some good stuff happening for us or some bad stuff happening for us.
Right.
But the fact that we're human beings doing that really kind of didn't make any difference.
But I don't.
You know,
Mag wasn't a metagame for some other game, so I don't understand the comparison there.
All right. Well, I hope it's awesome. I hope it's way more awesome than I thought.
It's taking part in a larger ground war thing that's part of some bigger thing.
Right, but in Mag's case, it was on the map. It was the thing. The uniqueness of 514, if it works, is that it is a metagame for a big MMO.
Right. Which I think is cool conceptually. I'm just saying, is the end user experience going to take full advantage of that fact?
I would also love to see it be very successful because it's so cool sounding. But
we're not arguing with you that it's cool.
I think it's interesting to ask the questions of, are they maybe coming at it the right way by being cautious and not going crazy with it? Because their point is that we still want it to be just a good PS3 shooter, because if we're a good PS3 shooter, people will want to play it.
I think that's that's what Jeff said, and I think that's the most important thing.
What is the on the ground action, and how rewarding is that, and how deep is it? You know, if it's like every other mission amounts to go to an outpost and kill X number of dudes and pick up a crate. I don't know.
Well, I think that they'll have to figure out how to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, but
there's a lot of games out there like this that are good, like Section 8. Good game, right?
Yeah.
Except hard to get it to populate because it is just another mission-based tactical shooter game. So here's a mission-based tactical shooter game where...
you're leveraging a built-in community.
Right. And so you know that for the first part, you're always going to have a certain baseline population playing it because their corporations are going to be pushing people in to go play it because they want to play it, which means there'll always be a player base. Which means if you find that it's interesting to you as a player, then you could also be able to go play it because you know there's always going to be people playing it.
Mm.
That's all I'm saying. I think that part's interesting.
Yeah, they could do the same thing for WoW. They could make some console spinoff.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that would be even way more how much more successful could that be?
Yeah.
Let's conceptualize that for a second.
I know, right?
Basically, they could have Warcraft 3 be, or Warcraft 4 be like an extension of World of Warcraft.
You could do a million things. You could have a 2D fighting game for pets.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of are having that turn-based.
Well, yeah, they're doing it turn-based, but I mean, you could bring that into a full-on action 2D combat game and boom. You know, anything.
I think there's a lot of ideas like that, but I think it's interesting in Eve because the thing that Eve brings to the table is this crazy society of people who are super engaged in the virtual world and really dedicated to pushing their corporation's agenda, and that will motivate them to go do this stuff. And that maybe maybe the guild world on some servers in WoW is still that strong to where those guilds would be so strong that they would push people to do that,
yes,
and they could do the same
absolutely
thing.
Absolutely, that's the case.
You know?
Yeah.
And you could probably easily do that. I mean, imagine a Torchlight sort of, I mean, it's really easy. Like imagine
Diablo?
Torchlight, like Diablo sort of game that was like linked into something like that, or, you know, any number of first person games you could pull like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's kind of, it's interesting idea. I guess I overstated the excitement, my enthusiasm for it. My core that I think is cool is the idea of building a tactical shooter, which needs a player base, and then giving it an automatic baseline group of people who will be playing it so that you could go play it on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Which is a tough struggle.
The tough balancing act is to make what you're doing in the first person shooter impacting, but they can't ever make it essential, because then you're worrying about these other people playing this other game. So
you're playing it wrong.
Yeah. So it's like, well, is it important or is it not important? It's a weird balancing act. Yeah. They have to walk.
Yeah. Okay.
Or run. Depending on
so, Jeff, you want a Mr. PC Gamer? You want a GTX 680? Do you?
Yeah,
$500.
Are you giving me one?
$500,
dude. Look at how much power does that thing suck, though? That was the thing that blew me away.
175 watts at idle, 192 max.
That's
so it is
idle. Jesus.
No, that's great.
No, that's awesome.
It has the power equivalent to like three GTX 580s.
That's crazy.
And it's running at less than even a third of the amount of power cost that it would cost you. So it's really nicely power efficient.
Yeah, the last two machines that I bought, when I got to video card, I was like, all right, what kind of power supply am I going to need?
Yeah, because 750 watts.
It's freaking ridiculous, some of these cards. But that's awesome.
Yeah, so what's interesting about this is that, and my go-to source for when I get into like really hardcore PC stuff oftentimes is Guru 3D. So I just I went and checked out Guru 3D and their review of it and some of their comments on it. Their assumption here is that this first Kepler product is actually thought of internally as a mid-level solution. The code number for it is GK104, and they think that if it had been like the high-end solution, it would be GK110. They got some other stuff about like what process it's built on or whatever. So this first chip, for all the things it does right, might not even be like the ultimate badass big time.
Is this what's going to be in our next gen consoles? Is this what we're looking at? This chipset?
You know, who knows?
Mayhaps,
but,
Jeff.
But some of the things that are cool that it does is, in addition to not having a heavy idle draw and being good on power, it also does automatic clock adjustments. So it changes its clock based on load to help it better, you know, deal with the power consumption ideas. What was the other thing it does? Oh, it's supposed to be quieter because it's supposed to run cooler. Now, had not seen as great a drop-off on temperature as they'd hoped for. They said you still hear it when it kicks in and goes into high speed.
I want all of that. Give it to me.
You want all that. So here's my question. $500 for a video card.
But isn't that kind of what high-end video cards go for?
They're all over the place.
Yeah. I mean, that's like that's usually when the big bad guy on the block gets announced. That's the price point.
And then
right?
You wait three to 6 months and buy it for like $200 cheaper.
Or you wait 3 to 6 months and buy the mid-level knock-on that goes with that series, which I think is really what a lot of people do, right? So I don't know. I mean, I just like one of the questions we had in the pre-show thing was about Steam boxes and whether or not, you know, PC gaming can go mainstream.
I'm confused about the Steam box. Let's talk about that for a second.
I heard that was just a rumor. It's not happening at all.
So it was a misunderstanding because Valve consistently builds boxes to represent typical machines that their customers have. And so they call them Valve boxes or Steam boxes. But, and that was where the misunderstanding came from.
I'm not even really concerned about the actuality of it. I'm just concerned about the concept that people got all excited about. I don't understand the excitement, and maybe you guys can enlighten me because
I don't think so.
No, because you agree with
me. Well, no, I was just, it was a big like, wait, you mean a PC?
Yeah. Well, it's like, well, if you have like a PC at a set standard that we can design for, but they do that already.
Right.
A and B, isn't the whole idea of PC gaming, what makes PC gaming so awesome is that they're always pushing the boundaries. And
now
that's
the core question.
So,
well, now, if Valve built a box that was a console, that was a, you know, Valve-branded thing, and they could roll out patches and updates and mods and all sorts of this, all the stuff they do now, Steamworks stuff.
On their own. OS?
Yeah.
Or on
but nobody's
a free
gonna,
OS?
But
and
nobody's
then people
gonna,
have to write different games and...
Nobody's going
to
put out a game on Steam that doesn't let you max out the settings beyond what this box could do at some point. There's not going to be like a year down the line, somebody's PC game is going to come out and you can't.
But a console is not never going to be, because that's what this is. It's an alternate console solution. And consoles will always not have the flexibility of, well, that's a double neck or whatever, won't right. have the flexibility to do that.
So what's exciting about it?
I don't know. That's why I said I don't know.
Yeah. I still think the trouble on the PC platform comes back to Microsoft's unwillingness to really get PC gaming right. And they haven't even tried in like 3 or 4 years now. It's just sad. I guess
they're too busy with Kinect, man.
It's just
really are they? Because all those awesome Kinect games that are coming out, those big.
Hey,
huge
Kinect
games.
I didn't say that they were hitting home runs, but they're busy with Kinect. Okay,
and they take a lot of resources to make.
All right, let's get busy with our finishing moves.
It's the weekend, and it's time for finishing moves.
Yeah. All right, Andrea Renee loves Assassin's Creed 3.
Oh my gosh, it's so amazing. If you guys haven't seen the feature in Game Informer, I highly recommend you check it out. The embargo lifts on Monday, I believe, so you'll be seeing a giant rollout across the web from a number of different outlets on the details, but I'm so excited that they went in the direction they did with the American Revolution and some of the things that they're doing. I mean, I can't go into too much detail because I'm under NDA, but it's going to be really, really awesome. And I was in the demo with people who said, I never cared about Assassin's Creed until after I watched this demo. Now I really want
USA,
to get into it.
USA!
So,
USA!
Some of the changes that they're making with the way that the game is played and you know, it just looks beautiful. Like, I mean, I'm excited. Assassin's Creed right. 3.
I never cared about Assassin's Creed because there's a bunch of foreigners in it. But now it's first. Americans.
Oh, dear God. All right, Jeff, dig yourself out of that one. Finish your move.
Oh, I was just being silly, as I'm wont to do. I killed the Americans. It's weekend confirmed, and if you're listening to this before Saturday at midnight and you're anywhere near the greater Los Angeles area, I hope you will come down and check out Double Jump, the show that Christian Spicer and I are putting together. We'll have some fun guests. Mega 64 will be there. Adam Sandler will be there. Adam Sessler will be there.
I keep got the wrong guy.
Oh, I'm really trying to pump this up. God.
How big is that theater? Like, right. I'm really concerned that like if I don't get there early that I'm not going to get a seat.
I'll put you on the list, Andrea. Don't worry about that. I'll get your hookup. Andrea's going to be there, evidently. Just in. So I hope you come in down. Garnett, planning to attend?
Yeah, I'll be there.
Awesome. Yep. And we'll all be hanging out afterwards.
So first 10 people to go up to the window and
so it starts at midnight?
Say weekend confirmed.
So midnight, so Sunday morning, technically.
We're saying 11:59 Saturday night, so as to avoid confusion.
Okay.
There you go. And you can also find out more at losangeles.ucbtheater.com. Shows view 3042.
And if you're listening to this after Saturday at midnight, thanks for coming. It was awesome to see you.
Jeff Mattis, your finishing move.
Yes. For Wing Commander fans out there, there is a fan-made game that just came out called Wing Commander Saga The Darkest Dawn, which is a fully like two campaigns, over 50 missions, fan-made Wing Commander game that
crazy.
Basically it's got the blessing of a lot of the original Wing Commander series creators, takes place before Wing Commander 3, built on the Free Space 2 engine. I haven't, the one caveat is I haven't checked it out yet, but it looks pretty cool.
So
check it out.
Awesome. Two-pronged one for me very quickly. Cinemora, which we didn't get to, but maybe I'll talk to you about some next week. Awesome. Really, really fun old-school shump with beautiful graphics and the time-slow maneuver that's really cool, which allows you to really navigate through these beautiful blossoms of weapon fire, which is what those sort of games are all about. It's really cool. It's very fun. And then big ups to the Giant Bomb crew.
Yeah.
And their
fantastic
acquisition by CBSI. I think that, you know, there was a little moment there where people were a little worried, but those guys,
yeah,
well deserved of some
above
great backing.
Reproach.
I can't wait to see what they do with a really, you know, great backing and solid foundation to play off of. Obviously, great guys, love them all, but good friends. But so happy for you guys. Really, really happy for you guys. Congratulations. It's freaking awesome. And you should listen to Bombcast because that's badass.
Indeed.
And that's all I have to say about that. All right, folks, that's your weekend confirmed. Follow Jeff on Totally Rad Show. Also, Jeff at Jeff Cannata on the Twitters.
With two N's and one T.
At Andrea Renee. Also, machinima.com.
That's right. Well, we live on YouTube, so youtube.com/machinima.
There you go.
Come see our awesome stuff.
And you know us. We're on shacknews.com, Mr. Mattis and I. And we also have a new daily video show that we're posting now.
Yeah, Shack do. News Daily. Daily. What?
Pretty cool.
Oh, well.
Which you can watch in the client or wherever else, or on Shack News or on YouTube. It's on the YouTubes. So there you go. All right, folks, that's it. That's your Weekend Confirmed. Until next week, we are Ghost. Work so hard that you know we play harder. Work so hard that you know we play harder. Yeah, come on. It took a minute for me to see what was going down. My body's vibrating, pulsating to the sound. Hey, bartender, hit me with another round. I got a feeling she's ready. Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is free and available now for iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices.